Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology, and about how you can make the most of your own life.
And this is Dr. Peter Bregan. Welcome, my wonderful audience, pioneers in the field of mental health, psychology, self-help, education, cutting-edge folks in critical research into science of psychiatry, drugs, lobotomy, electroshock. My guests and my audience, very similar people, all really highly dedicated and innovative. And today is no exception. Krista, are you there? Can you hear me clearly? Hello?
Hello, can you hear me?
Yep. Oh, you sound very, very good and clear. Before I tell you more about Krista, I want to get to the basics of what life is about, because really she's going to be talking about that. 2 million years ago, all of us, our ancestors, were little tiny bipeds toddling around on 2 feet, climbing out of trees, maybe hanging around those trees, maybe living in one great big tree. We were extended families. Gradually, we began wandering more about as extended families. And for 2 million years, leading up to only 5 or 10,000 years ago, think about that, for 2 million years, we evolved and developed as members of small, relatively small bands of extended families. The average band size is estimated to have been 25, 35 people, but it's thought that sometimes there were just a few people, rarely 100 people maybe. Rarely that, and that only as we get nearer to 10,000 years ago. So we are creatures of the family. We learn to speak in the family, to love in the family. We learn how to have sexual relations from being in the family, because we don't have a lot of instincts that give us a detailed blueprint on life. So we are basically made of each other as we develop in the family. And this has been the story for 2 million years. Then 10 to 15,000 years ago, some places 5,000 years ago, some places even sooner, we began to develop into farmers living in one spot. And that's the beginning of villages and towns and eventually cities. But we didn't evolve to live in towns and cities. We evolved to live in families, and I outline all of this in the opening section of my book, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, so we can understand who we really are. And what this means to me is that the quality of life is enormously determined nowadays, as forever, by the quality of our family life, and that the most basic healing occurs within our family lives. And we at the present time may only have one or two or three real interventions in the world that are based on family. And we have visiting us today Krista McKinnon, who has one of the few, maybe the only program, will it? Her tell us about that, of online education for families in distress that doesn't educate, doesn't emphasize drugs, shock treatment, diagnoses, and taking money from the drug companies. So I'm just going to turn the mic over. Well, no, I'll tell you a little more about Kristen. I will tell you a little more. She's a mental health specialist, and she works in working in the capacities of peer support and family support, group facilitation, community online organizing and working together. And her online program is FamiliesHealingTogether.com. FamiliesHealingTogether.com. She's Canadian, but she's worldwide. Krista McKinnon, please take over and start wherever you like telling us about yourself.
Yeah, thank you. I loved how you talked about sort of the history of how we're all born into families and how we've evolved. And it got me thinking about social programming and social conditioning. So, you know, families are this rich breeding ground for love and healing, but also, of course, dysfunction, a lot of the social conditioning that happens in families. You know, you were saying, you know, we learn everything in families. We learn about sexual relations in families. We learn from our family unit, you know, and I think a lot of the work that I do around families healing together is like what families pick up from the greater culture and greater society around what it means to be diagnosed with a mental illness is not necessarily what they want to bring into their, smaller family unit. Like families learn, for example, let's just create a scenario. So let's say there's two partners and a son, and the son gets diagnosed with schizophrenia, and the two partners are asking the doctor, you know, what does that mean? What do we do now? How do we help? And what they learn from society is that, you know, people with schizophrenia are dangerous and all the stigma attached. That's what they learn. That's the social programming that happens in society around something like a diagnosis of schizophrenia. And then, you know, the partners are asking the doctor, what does it mean? How do we help him? What do we do? And the doctor says, well, he has a broken brain. He needs to take these drugs. He'll have to take them for the rest of his life. So the social programming, social conditioning that happens in society and then on a more microscopic level within the family around mental health problems, emotional distress, can be really damaging to the kind of support and healing and love and growth that families actually have to offer in a situation of emotional distress.
Well, that sounds just spot on to me. So I'm just going to ask you to say more about it. You could talk about the background that you have that got you into this direction. People are always interested in that. Or you could go right ahead and just talk some about your actual program.
Sure. My own family, for example, I was 16 years old and I was diagnosed with bipolar disorder. And my own family didn't really know what to do with that. Very loving mom and dad who wanted to, you know, support me to be a happy, independent adult, I think. But they were told, you know, I would have a lifelong disability. I was told I would have a lifelong disability. The medical community kind of taught my parents that they had to control me. They had to make sure that I took my meds or else I would have another psychotic episode. It was very dangerous, precarious. So that sort of created an environment in my family where I could no longer access my parents as support because they became the watchdogs kind of. And I see this a lot I see this as a trap that families get into, because I think that a better role for the family is to become an ally to their family member who's in distress. So, and that's not to negate the medical community, but it's to say, like, you know, what is going on with you right now? Like, how do you actually feel? What do you think can improve the quality of your life? How can we as a family improve the quality of our life together? And, you know, those are the sort of the more important questions that family has to address. So, I mean, that was my own family situation. And then I went on to study social work and later worked, you know, ended up getting a job working with families. And I felt really it felt very purposeful to me that I had this opportunity to sort of make sure that families didn't fall into that same kind of power dynamic trap that my own family fell into. So, I mean, the class that I run, Families Healing Together, it's an 8-week curriculum that is very different than the psychoeducation curriculum that families are usually given, because usually families are taught these are some diagnoses: obsessive compulsive disorder, schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, depression, and these are the symptoms of those illnesses, and these are the drugs used to treat those symptoms, and here's what you can expect. And that's kind of it. I mean, that's the education that families are given. So here's this incredibly emotional experience that's happening for one person in the family that, of course, affects the rest of the family in all sorts of complex ways. And that's kind of all the education they're given. It's presented as this fact-based kind of like, okay, here's how it is now. So this curriculum is very different from that. The curriculum in Families Healing Together, there's no information about, you know, what bipolar disorder is, what schizophrenia is, no distinction between any of those things, because what the class is about is relationship. You know, what the class is about is, it's about sharing the stories of so many people who've been diagnosed with mental illnesses who went on to live very full, happy, well lives, and they tell their stories of recovery. That's what the class is about. You know, the class is about how do you help someone who's struggling to see their power and their purpose? And how do you see yours, your own power and purpose as you're supporting this person through this incredible life experience of you know, extreme emotions, however they may be manifesting?
Tell me more about that. I think there's nothing more important in the world than empowering and giving purpose to people who are going through terrible times that somebody else other than you or I might call manic depressive or bipolar disorder or schizophrenia or depersonalization or whatever else. But by the way, is the program at all tailored in any way to those diagnoses? It sounds like not.
No, it's not. That's absolutely great. Yeah, I know. I mean, because I don't really see any point in it being catered to those things. Like, you know, I mean, there's one lesson in the class that talks about, you know, the Diagnostic Statistical Manual is a book of symptoms and disorders, right? It categorizes people into these groups. And the people who come to the class have a family member usually who's been put into one of those categories in that book. And one of the lessons in the class sort of flips that on its head and says, you know, there's this psychologist named Martin Seligman, and he flipped that approach on his head and instead wrote an 1,816-page book called The Character, Strengths, and Virtues, A Handbook and Classification. And it's like sort of the opposite of that. It's like a book filled of all the different kinds of human strengths that people have. And so, you know, one of the lessons in the class is like, sure, your relative has been given this label that came from this book that people wrote based on certain behaviors and categories. But I mean, if we're going to categorize people in that way, why don't we also look at this other way of categorizing people that looks at, you know, the basic human strengths and virtues that is a common core and common thread in all of humanity. Like, you know, and those are things like creativity, curiosity, open-mindedness, love of learning, perspective, bravery, you know, and these are traits that, you know, somebody could have 7 different diagnoses in the DSM, and they could also have, you know, 100 strengths of, you know, 100 different virtues and strengths that are also part of who they are. So what I see a lot with families is they become problem saturated. You know, they're so worried about the diagnosis and the symptoms that they may be seeing, or what gets called symptoms, that they lose sight of sort of the very fiery, passionate, alive person who's filled with strengths and virtues that's living in there. You know, it just gets lost, and it doesn't have to. It's like people, people sometimes need help to find it, because in the face of adversity and distress and diagnoses and the medical community and the mental health system, a lot of that stuff gets buried, you know, and becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy within the family and for the individual. So I see the class as an opportunity for people to, for families to move. It's not just families. I mean, professionals and people in recovery take the class too, but it's mostly families. And it's an opportunity for them to move from a place of like stuck and hopeless and isolated to sort of greater capacity to see the beauty of life, to see that there's greater purpose behind everything that's happening. And maybe if you scratch a little deeper, instead of just the surface of, you know, diagnosis A, medication B, like if you scratch a little deeper, that, you know, through self-reflection and peer support and having like a recovery practice where you actually, you know, take it on to become a support person for yourself and your relative in a way that is hope inspiring and seeing possibility. I mean, that's the stuff of, that's how you make adversity beautiful and meaningful. You know, it's like, I get really frustrated when I see how problem saturated, how easy it is for things to become problem saturated and stuck. And how easy it is with just simple, small behaviors to shift it, you know? So I get very excited when people register for the class, because it's such an opportunity to change the culture of a family. Because usually when families come to the class, it's because they're in that stuck, hopeless, isolated, kind of desperate feeling place. And then it sort of provides them with skills and tools and a community to explore different ways of being and different ways of seeing the situation and different ways of relating really with one another.
Oh, I just love listening to you, Krista. We're talking with Krista McKinnon, and you can find her at familieshealingtogether.com. I mean, everything you're saying resonates with me. I have to, you know, pull myself out of the psychiatric approach that I lapse into once in a while, a little bit, and get back on this, exactly what you're talking about, which ultimately what we can do for people is empower them, help them find hope, help them discover what kind of rich life they want, and hopefully within the context of family, do people end up, can people benefit from your online program, which actually, did you mention that it is, we talked about that it's $200 or something online?
Mm-hmm. It's $249 and it's an 8-week class. And what happens basically is people get 2 or 3 emails per week. There are 17 in total in the class and it goes over 8 weeks. And the email has all of the curriculum and the content, and it gives them a link into a private password-protected discussion space where people take the downloadable worksheets and the articles and the content and the question prompts, and they have discussion in the private area around that. So, I mean, the class is designed so that in the beginning it's about, you know, exploring recovery fundamentals, understanding mental health, and moves into hope. Then we talk about strength. And later on in the course, it gets more sort of emotional and needy in that we start to talk about, you know, how do you create healthy boundaries? How do you communicate amidst psychosis? So, I mean, that's like a lot of families just, you know, they sort of are like, you know, I don't even see my relative in there anymore. It's like they're not even themselves. They're in another world. So, like, that may be how they're feeling, but that they don't have to stay stuck in that place. So we get into the nitty-gritty of, like, okay, if somebody's in a totally different reality from you, how are you going to connect with them? Because the most important tool you have in recovery is your relationship. Like, that's it. That's all I got. You know, you don't get to control them. You don't get to tell them what to do. You can't make their choices for them, but you can have a good relationship with them. So how do you do that? So we get to explore that. And yeah, I mean, the kinds of conversations that happen in the class are are really raw and vulnerable and beautiful. And I think what I love most about the curriculum in the class is that people register for the class usually because they don't know what to do. They're in a place of despair. They feel isolated. They feel stuck, but they think they're there to help their relative who has a diagnosis. So they're, you know, like, what are they going to do? What are they going to, my relative needs to do this, but they don't. They're just sitting on the couch. They think it's all about their relative. And by the end of the class, people have the most incredible insights into their own behavior. You know, that's what excites me about doing this work is, you know, you can only control yourself. You can only control your own reactions, your own responses, and you can only hope that in your own behavior, you know, by virtue of acting from a true, thoughtful, conscious place, it will inspire the people in your life to live their best life. I mean, that's all a family member can do. So I think a lot of help is sort of trying to help families realize their role. And more clear, like, what is their business? And how do they love their relative in a way that honors their autonomy, basically?
We're going to go to a brief, I guess you're doing good. Say a few more words, Krista. You were breaking up a little bit, but we think it's good now. Say a few words about who's monitoring this. Are you always the monitor? Okay. Is there another monitor that's at work? I think we may have lost Krista.
I'm here.
Okay. Did you hear me that you've been breaking up?
Yes, that's unfortunate. I wish I could do something about that.
Okay. Talk some about who's doing the monitoring. Are you? Is it always you? Are there other people?
Yeah, I'm always moderating the classes, but I have three volunteers who have been consistently working with me, helping moderate the class for about a year now. They've all been working with me for about a year, and they are incredible. So two of them are family members who took the class initially, and one is a person who he calls himself his own family member. He has a diagnosis himself and lives very well. He's traveling the world right now, and he has a website where he talks about all his travels. But he's a person who very much lives to inspire wellness in other people. And so I feel really lucky to have them with me. So there's myself moderating the discussions and then the three people who are volunteering as well.
And how long is it usually? How long is a usual session?
Well, the class is 8 weeks long.
No, I mean these discussion questions where people are getting involved and sharing all their information, their feelings and thoughts.
Right. It happens online in a non-time-specific way. So every week there are two or three lessons are released every week. And people, you know, come and comment on the curriculum at any time that it's convenient for them. So, you know, it's interesting to see because people sometimes will come to the class at, you know, 2 a.m. and they're very upset about an interaction that just happened, and they'll bring it to the class and, you know, people are taking the class from all over the world. Like there are all different time zones in the class. So it's pretty active at all hours in terms of people typing and commenting to one another, but there's no specific time frame. So, you know, will be commenting on, you know, lessons in the beginning all the way till the end of the class. So it's kind of, you know, for the whole 8 weeks, there's a pretty rich discussion happening.
How many people are taking the class usually at any one time?
It's hard to say. It seems to really fluctuate. And often people will take it and just read along, but they won't comment, and then they'll email me and they'll say, you know, I'm enjoying it so much, but I just feel too shy to comment. So I know they're like involved, but the not everybody gets into the act of, you know, the discussion. Some people find the discussion super helpful, and some people just kind of like to watch. But what was your question? Sorry, I think I might have missed it.
No, we're doing fine. Are the people who are usually talking the frustrated family members who don't know what to do?
Yeah.
That would be my guess. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a personality thing, too. Like, just some people are more inclined to be more open, and some people like to talk, work their way through things in that way. But, yeah, it tends to be, you know, the discussions tend to be people who are very struck by the, you know, something, there'll be a piece of an article that really spoke to them and it had them, they suddenly see their whole situation differently, and they'll write about that, and then other people will chime in. You know, the week that we talk about boundaries, people actually, the worksheet that there's a worksheet that helps them to identify what boundaries they might need to set and how they might go about doing that. So sometimes the discussions will be really concrete, like specific life examples where people will say, you know, this is the situation with my husband and this is the boundary I think I need to set, but I'm afraid to. If, you know, if I set it like this, using this formula, does that feel better than if I say it this way, but I'm scared? And then somebody else will chime in and say, oh, you know, I once tried to do it this way. So, I mean, people just get into really collaborative sort of conversations around viewing things from different perspectives and trying different ways of addressing complex issues and supporting one another to try different things.
I'm so in agreement with this basic orientation that family is the center and the hope and the healing, especially when clients are relatively – when the identified patient is relatively young. But even when they're older and whenever they're dependent on family, again, family has to play a key role in the healing. I love your concept that the most important thing is to be there in a genuine, real, and loving way. And I like your emphasis on boundaries, because I think in order to be real and loving and caring with each other, we all also have to know how to say, no, please don't talk to me that way, or no, that's too dangerous. Or we have to be able to express our need for boundaries in everything from intimacy at any given moment to how we're talked to. So I like so much of what you're stressing. How much do people participate who were the original identified patient and may indeed be going through experiences that seem strange and alien to their families? How much do they actually get a chance to not get a chance, but how much do they have the strength to participate in something like this?
Yeah, I would say, I mean, this isn't like an actual statistic. I'm kind of just doing some guesswork here, but I would say maybe 15% of the people who take the class are in that position, like are in recovery themselves or have some psychiatric diagnosis themselves. And we'll talk about that. It seems like the experience that people in that situation tend to have in the class is that they kind of start to have more empathy for their family, because it's really interesting, because it works both ways. So when there's somebody in the class who's taking the class as a psychiatric survivor, consumer, or whatever you want to call it, they're open about their experience. So they'll talk about what it's like for them and what they struggle with and how they relate to the material. The families are so grateful to have that voice represented, that they're, you know, very interested. And like, so discussions will happen between them that are like, oh, you know, my daughter is like this. What do you think that's about? You know? And then the person who's in recovery themselves will be like, well, from my perspective, you know, my family treats me this way and I find it really frustrating. And then, so conversations happen where they're like, oh God, I think I do that to my daughter too. You know? So it's like, it's really fluid. And then there are professionals who take the class as well. So it becomes a very rich, you know, the majority of people who take the class are family members, but the conversations sometimes get to be quite cross-section because it's, you know, all the different perspectives are all represented.
Just then you began to break up a tiny bit. You're on Skype, aren't you?
Yeah,
so there's probably nothing you can do about that.
Yeah, I'm not sure what it is. I called in through Skype. That's unfortunate.
Yeah.
Does that happen often? Do people break up or?
No, but sometimes. I do. I've had that experience on my end too. But it's going fine. Now, as far as I know, you're the only group that's really doing this right now, and you're being supported by the Foundation for Excellence in Mental Health, and we've had their leadership on our program a few times and will again.
Mm-hmm.
Is that true? Are you the only group that's doing this now that's not being supported by the drug companies?
Right. Actually, the program is supported completely and entirely by tuition. So it's not this, it's supported infrastructurally by the foundation, but what keeps the program running is that's why there's a fee for service, because the program is funded by the tuition of the class. But it is the only one of its kind. So I was working in Toronto developing curriculum at a program called Family Outreach and Response. And we, at Family Outreach and Response, created this recovery-oriented family mental health curriculum. And nowhere else in the world had created any kind of recovery-oriented family work. So, you know, organizations, systems all over the world are embracing the idea of recovery, but somehow it has not translated into family work yet. So we were this, you know, small organization in Toronto developing this family recovery-oriented mental health curriculum, and people all over the world were very interested in what we were doing. But we were a small organization, and it wasn't our mandate to do public outreach or public education, that we were funded by the government to serve our clients, not to educate organizations in Australia or New Zealand or wherever. And we were, you know, getting a lot of interest from places all over the world and like, how can we do recovery-oriented family work? So eventually it made sense to take what we were doing and put the curriculum online so that it's available internationally, because it really is the only family recovery-oriented curriculum out there. So it's nice that now it can be shared online, and I'm grateful to be alive in the internet age that makes this possible. But it's spreading, and there's an organization in Australia called Helping Minds, who we've developed a partnership with. So Families Healing Together works with Helping Minds in Australia, and they're actually, as an organization, sponsoring people to take the class so that people personally don't have to foot the bill to take the class. And they're working on a government level to try and have the government pay for people to take the class. So that's really exciting for me, because what I want more than anything is for this curriculum to be available to anyone who's interested in it, you know, for free, ideally.
Are you in touch with anybody in Great Britain? This show has a lot of connections with Great Britain as well as Australia.
No. I mean, Rufus May is what, you know, the curriculum is filled with, you know, amazing people doing great work. And Rufus May is in Bradford, I think. And there's a piece of his in the curriculum about understanding the psychotic experience. And he knows about the program because he's in it. But that's really the only, I don't really have a lot of, I don't know very many. And I don't get many students from the UK, actually. I get a lot from New Zealand and a lot from Australia. I've had a few from Ireland. But not much in the UK. So that's great. Anybody listening from the UK, you know, take the class.
When you get a chance, email me a connection to Rufus May. It sounds like he'd be a good person to have on this show to talk about the experience of people who are called psychotic. Does that sound good?
Sure. Yeah, he would be great on the show. He's very charismatic and a great speaker and has a lot to say. He would be great for your show. Yeah.
Do you know anything about MIND, M-I-N-D, in Great Britain? It's their National Mental Health Association, sort of. It's very government-oriented, but also I think some private. Let me see if I get you a connection to that, okay?
Sure, sure, great.
All right, well, yeah, you should definitely be all over all the English-speaking countries, for sure. Golly, where would you like to take what we're talking about now? Do you want to talk more about how you encourage people to view this lived experience and for family members to see it? You mentioned Rufus May. He's a name that I'm not familiar with. Usually I'm familiar with, as my audience knows, with the names that come up. Can you tell us more about that? What kind of encouragement are you giving in the way of viewing experiences that family members feel are schizophrenic or manic or the like?
Yeah. I mean, I encourage that, you know, there's the curriculum of the class, and then there's the discussions that happen. And, you know, on a personal level, when I'm communicating with the students of the class, if they're asking me, you know, for example, let's use an example. So my son believes that that there are black car, every black car that passes the house is spying on him. And it's very distressing to the whole family because he gets very upset every time a black car passes the house. So something like that, usually by the time a family is in the class, they've become very frustrated by whatever kinds of unusual beliefs or, you know, what gets called psychotic thinking is happening. And what I'll try and have families do is think about it from the perspective of sort of like almost like a dream. Like what, okay, I it's like I get that it's frustrating that you don't understand it, but what if there is some deeper meaning beneath these cars, what might it be? Like, what is his association with black cars? So it's almost like getting families to be curious about the experience rather than just dismissing it. So somebody who's, you know, having a lot of focused thinking about black cars, for somebody who's not having that reality, it creates a disconnect between them, you know, because the other person's like, that's ridiculous. Those black cars are not, they're not surveilling you, like, get over it, you know. It creates a rupture in the relationship. So like what I'm always trying to reinforce to them is like, you don't have to say, oh yeah, I know that those cars are following you or they're surveilling you, but you can ask about it. You can be curious about it. You can wonder, you know, what that means for them. And, you know, maybe in having a curiosity about their life, just a depth of connection will start to generate some healing. And I've seen that happen. I've seen families go from like just being sort of disconnected and resentful and angry and upset to curious, and then more conversations start happening and things start, stagnant situations start moving differently and things start happening. I mean, you know, sometimes something as basic as having curiosity and interest and looking for the meaning behind what seems to have no meaning can actually create big shifts relationally. And when there are big shifts relationally in the family, that gives, if they're positive shifts, that helps somebody to have more strength in their life, you know?
It all sounds so good to me. This is how I relate to my clients or patients.
Yeah.
And how I encourage their families to do. It's the opposite of what young psychiatric residents are taught and what modern psychiatrists are doing, which
right.
is, you know, their logo is you can't talk to schizophrenia. And
right.
in fact, if you are willing and create trust, a lot of what we call hallucinations and delusions are very similar to nightmares, not just dreams, but often nightmares. And they often have a lot of rootedness in childhood experiences and childhood abuse. Is that your experience too? That a lot of it's rooted in childhood abuse?
Yep, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, this isn't particular childhood abuse, but it just reminds me of this one professional who took the class who had been working as a case manager with a man for a really long time. She cared very deeply for him. And he was sort of stuck in his own life. He had this idea that his foot was evil. And a great majority of his thinking energy was put into the fact that his foot was evil. So, you know, of course, the people around him would just sort of be like, that's ridiculous. You know, you have to get over, you have to move on, you have to do other things, you have to create life goals. But he was really focused on his foot being evil. And so this woman, this professional who was working with him as a case manager, started to be curious instead of just, you know, dismissing this idea that his foot is evil, and was asking him a lot of questions about it. And the further in curiosity she got, and the further he, the more he felt comfortable in opening up with her and talking about his evil foot, which is something nobody really asked him about because they just dismissed it as crazy. What actually ended up coming to light was that many years ago, he had been in a car accident and had killed somebody in, you know, a passenger in another car was killed as a result of this car accident. So suddenly it made sense that he had the belief that his foot was evil because his foot was on the gas pedal.
Wow. I just think that's such good work. Now, here's a tough one. How in the world do you deal with the reality that so many families of identified patients have, in fact, brutalized them, often as little children, or at best have just not had the communication abilities or skills because of their own abuse in childhood to relate to their kids? So does that come up? And I have trouble figuring out how you relate to that, especially online, or maybe it's easier online.
Yeah, I think, I mean, in some ways it's easier online because people can choose to take the class anonymously. So, you know, their username can be Purple Flower or, you know, anything they want. So because of that anonymity, sometimes it gives people more license to be really incredibly honest. So people will admit things that they might not admit in like a face-to-face, real-time, real-life group because of the shame. You know, so people have said, you know, there was one mom who took the class who said, you know, she knows that she believes that the reason that her son was struggling with you know, what was being called psychosis was because of the abuse that he faced from her husband, who was his stepdad. And she was able to, like, it wasn't something she talked about in her actual real life because she had so much shame around it. She married this man who basically, you know, physically would beat her son, and she stayed married to him. And it went on for several years. And then as a teenager, he went on to have, you know, what was called psychotic experiences, and eventually labeled schizophrenia. So she had all this guilt that she believed he did not have something called schizophrenia, but that he was sort of purging kind of all of the trauma that he faced growing up at the hands of her husband. And for her, it was something that she did not feel she could talk about ever in real life with anyone. You know, so she was, in a way, in the class, she was able to kind of talk about some of her guilt and shameful feelings around that upbringing, that she felt that's why her son was struggling as a, you know, as he went into his own manhood and becoming a man. And the fact that she could talk about it in the class helped her to, you know, find ways to feel more comfortable addressing it with her son. You know, so later she felt, because she had had the opportunity to kind of air it a little bit in the class, it was easier for her to approach him and you know, ask him about that and what was that like for you, and apologize to him for that. And so, yeah, I don't mean to sound like it's, you know, anybody, like that families make people get diagnosed with schizophrenia by abusing them. this, like, you know, an old thing that families get blamed. But, I mean, we are all responsible for one another, and we're all responsible for our behaviors and the ways in which we hurt and love each other. And it's not to say it's anybody's fault, but, I mean, when people have traumatic family upbringings, they're, you know, some accountability has to happen, and some deep soul searching, and some apologies, and moving forward, hopefully in a better way, you know.
Well, I like the way you talk about these things. From my viewpoint, I often see individuals whose families have actually been horribly abusive.
Yeah.
Sexually, emotionally, and on occasion I see people who have been subjected to ritual sexual abuse.
Yeah.
Which, folks, does exist. Believe me, it exists. There are books about it. It's common enough for that.
Yeah.
Where, you know, you have a small community of people, often out in the country, often farming,
right.
But not always. Could be a suburb. Could be a city where a number of families are involved in abusing their children. Now, when I see these folks, obviously neither they nor I particularly imagine that they should be getting together with their families.
No.
In fact, it may be that I'll bring up, or they'll bring up, prosecuting their families. And sometimes people end up in jail as a result of what they did to my client. So do folks like this who have no family resources to turn to, do they ever become involved in your program, and how would they go about it?
You know, it's not who comes to my program. I mean, the people who take Families Healing Together are people who want to be good support people. That's usually who take the class. And sometimes people who are in recovery themselves take the class because they want to see if they think their family should take it, or they just want to get a recovery education. They want to learn what mental health recovery is, if they've never, you know, they're just, so like the people who are interested in Families Healing Together tend to not be the, you know, not what you're describing. Like I don't think those families would be interested to take the program.
Exactly. That's right.
But the thing that I want to say about that is that, you know, I've worked with a lot of people over the course of my career who have, you know, who are consider themselves psychiatric survivors and activists, who have had really bad family situations and have chosen adamantly to no longer communicate with their family because it is absolutely not healthy for them to do so. And sometimes they'll be interested in my work, not because they want to get back together with their family, but they want to know how to not recreate that kind of family situation for themselves in whatever family they create.
I think that would be a really nice theme for you to push a little bit in terms of having survivors of horrible abuse get to talk with families that have gone through turmoil, but in which there's more trust and love.
Yeah.
Because for some of these families, I'm sure you'll agree, I mean, some of these victims of horrible abuse, it would still be dangerous to go anywhere near their family. Still dangerous.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, and this is where formed family becomes so important. I mean, you know, I've had some pretty alternative family situations in my own adult life, and I'm a big believer in formed family. I don't, you know, people say family is blood, and blood is thicker than water, all these expressions that I mean, I don't know. Sometimes your family is absolutely the opposite of what you need to become a strong, powerful, free, self-loving individual. Like, it's just true that sometimes, you know, what you have to do is actually form your own family. But no matter what you do with your family of origin, the family you were born into, you're a human being and you have interpersonal connections, and you know, it's like we all have the freedom to create our own families, you know, our formed families of best friends, of allies, of people who support us. So, I mean, you know, for situations where the family of origin, the blood family, is not going to help encourage freedom and wholeness, you know, I don't know. I mean, there's a time and place for addressing that, maybe, but I don't see a lot of, you know, families that are really painfully abusive. They're not really interested in families healing together, you know?
No, they're going to the family organizations that are sponsored by drug companies.
Yes, right.
And drugging and shocking their kids and stuff. It's
exactly.
Their offspring, not their kids usually, but their older offspring.
Yeah, because
Krista,
it's easy to say, oh, well, they're crazy. That person is crazy. They have a diagnosis of schizophrenia. So like, whatever I do it can create some really bad dynamics for power and control gone way wrong in families. You know, if a family sets up this scenario where they other their relative as like the crazy person, so nothing that they say is relevant or has any value, that's, you know, it's pretty hard for somebody in a family like that to get well.
Folks, I never met Krista McKinnon. I only knew of her indirectly because I know the folks at the Foundation for Excellence in Mental Health who are helping her with some funds. But I'm just stunned by you. I just think you are so on target about every word comes out of your mouth. I'm thinking to myself, that's clarity, that's truth, and that's even beauty.
How'd you
get to this wonderful place? From my viewpoint, it's a wonderful place. It feels like the same place I'm in.
Yeah.
How'd you get there?
I know what a compliment that is because you have such an incredible body of work behind you. So to thank you for saying that. I think I care a lot about the human spirit. I care very deeply about freedom and autonomy and purpose. And when I started working with families and I would see them put all the power on their relative, like, oh, you know, they make their whole life be about their, you know, what they're considering their sick relative. It's like, it would just kill me to see that waste of human potential. So I think my whole career has been like, I want the family members to realize that they have the power, no matter who their relatives are or what diagnosis they have or what's going on with them, to live a beautiful life. And they also have the power to respect and honor their relatives' individual journey. And they might have to learn sort of like how to appreciate diversity and difference of experience and different ways of being in the world. And that'll help them grow and make them be a stronger, more interesting person. And it's like ultimately I want everybody to feel their own freedom. And when family members would come to get counseling, they would just not have any freedom because they would feel like their sick relative was like controlling their life or their life. And it's not true. You know, like nobody has to live that way. Everybody can find their individual freedom. I mean, we have oppressive systems that we have to advocate against and work hard to change. But even amidst that, everybody can find their personal freedom. And I think that I'm committed to that. And I think that's what's helped. That's what helps keep me interested in the work.
Well, you come from love.
Yeah.
Any particular inspiring person for you? Was it Martin Seligman?
I like his work a lot. I think the concept of learned helplessness is incredibly valuable for families to understand so that they don't create that in their family dynamic. That's been helpful. But I find Brené Brown's work really applicable to mental health. You know, she's a shame and resilience researcher.
Yeah, she's got this famous, you know, video that's been seen by millions.
The Power of Vulnerability.
The TED Talk.
Yes. Yeah, and she's gone on to write more books and speak more. And I think her work, you know, it hasn't really, it doesn't seem like it's really hit the mental health world, but it's so relevant. It's so, all of her work on shame and imperfection, and it's just, it's really relevant to what gets labeled mental illness and what happens in families. So I'm deeply inspired by her work as well.
Yeah, everything you're talking about resonates so much with my book, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety. I think you're going to be very, you're going to find yourself really aligned with it. And the last third of it is about how to have loving relationships, how to make love the center of our lives.
Yeah.
It is impossible to be crazy and loving at the same time. It's impossible to be helpless and loving at the same time.
Right, right. I'm really inspired lately by the work of Byron Katie. Do you know her by chance?
Nope.
So she doesn't work in mental health, but she has a she's known for something called The Work, which is four questions that she asks people to help them clarify their thoughts and to question their thoughts, to question the reality of their thoughts. And she,
spell her name for me, would you?
Spell it?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's Byron Katie. She's a very fascinating woman, but she, it's a self-inquiry process that she guides people through. And basically it's, you know, these four questions that help people think about their thoughts. So the four questions are, is it true? Can you absolutely know that it's true? How do you react when you believe that thought? And who would you be without the thought? So the four, those four questions, she applies them to all sorts of things, with all sorts of situations, with all kinds of different people. And it's interesting, you know, it's because it's just a very useful thought exercise. I mean, even if you think about, okay, my son is schizophrenic and he'll never live a good life again. Is that true? Well, yes, it's true. That's what I can see that happening in his life. Well, can you absolutely know that's true? Well, not really, because you can't predict the future and you don't know. And, you know, so anyway, I find her work fascinating because it's, you know, a thought exercise that is useful to, you know, because you don't have to believe everything you think.
Krista McKinnon is my guest, folks. I didn't know her before this show, and I love and admire her after this show.
Thank
Krista,
you.
I just think what you're doing is incredibly important. You can find her at familieshealingtogether.com. It's worth going there just to get a feeling for what she's doing. And I hope that your work is going to spread around the world.
Yeah.
And I'm going to certainly let folks in Great Britain in the next few days know more about what you're doing and see if we can develop some contacts for you there.
Wonderful. Yeah, I'm excited that it's you know, Singapore, Malaysia, New Zealand, and Australia. There's a big effort right now. There's an organization that's really working hard to spread the word about this curriculum there. So I would love to have, you know, people on the ground in other parts of the world doing the same thing.
Well, that's the music, and we will be leaving now. And thank you, folks, for listening. Tell other people about this show. Make a note that it's a good show. It's worth people hearing. Bye-bye now.